Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We have health and nutrition, including the Salk Institute new study published in Endocrine Reviews about how intermittent fasting can help manage metabolic disease. When you consider about one-third or more of all adults suffer from metabolic disorders, diabetes, etc., that's important. That's only one of many I'm going to share with you. But then I'm setting aside the majority of our program, probably 45 minutes, to have an interview with one of the greatest thinkers in America, Chris Hedges. So let your friends know, if they like really in-depth thinking, that Chris is going to be on in about 10 minutes or so. And I'm going to be asking Chris about something that does not get the attention it deserves: the failure of our justice system, the inherent racism in that system, the disproportionate number of people who are innocent but are still behind bars, and how it's been privatized, corporatized. So we're going to have an in-depth discussion on that, because I've worked as a volunteer in the prison system, but Chris has done it for many years. So it's just a different way of approaching everything. A little different show today. But then on Monday's show, wow, you're going to hear testimony at an FDA conference of specialists, meaning their own handpicked people. And this woman, Dr. Rose, who is MD, PhD, in academic background, pro-vaccine, ultra-orthodox, wait till you see the charts. Her segment's only 4 minutes long. You'll see the chart showing over a 1,000% increase in adverse events this year alone, and it's not over, compared to the last 20 years of all deaths and adverse events, and how she's recommending people not get the boosters of different ages, certain ages, and why. It's rare to have someone who sits on the inside of the FDA on a panel. You have the access to this, and it's only because I managed to get the audio file of this. But then more importantly, we're going to have a 20-minute segment with Whitney Webb, in my opinion, one of the five best investigative journalists in the world, telling you who's behind COVID, specific names and corporations, and everything about them. And there's no better scholar alive on this topic than she. That's an exclusive that you'll see and hear on Monday's show. Just want to let you know, we're not done with that. And also, if a lot of people listen by downloading from the archives, that's good. So we'd like people to know that they can download any of the shows. Let me just give you our archive number to download anything you need. And that archive number is 631-359-9463, 631-359-9463. Now to the latest on health and healing. And we began with the idea that people have a lot of health problems. And intermittent fasting, and what I mean by intermittent fasting, is that eat your last meal of the day as, let's say, early evening as you can. Let's say 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. But then don't eat your breakfast until, ideally, at least 12 hours later, or 13 or 14. That helps. But eating your daily calories within a consistent window of 8 to 10 hours is a powerful strategy to prevent and manage chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease. That's based upon an article published in the Endocrine Society's journal, Endocrine Reviews. So time-restricted eating, meaning don't eat all day and night, as most people do. Have a time for your breakfast, your lunch, and a small, very small, light dinner. And you're going to be helped. Blood sugar will be helped. Blood pressure will be helped. Your heart will be helped. Also from Virginia Tech University, a new study, where they say there's a lot of benefit to olives and olive oil. I remember last time I was in Italy, there was this old home. It was hundreds of years old, and the same lineage had lived there generation after generation. And they couldn't have been nicer. They was just so wonderful. It was up in the country near the Alps. And one wall had, I'm going to guess, 50 big jars of olives, all types of olives. And every jar was a different type of olives. And then they had all kinds of olive oil, very thick olive oil. I remember she passed around to us some homemade bread, and there was a cup in the middle. And I said, what's that? And it was olive oil. And I said, that looks like car oil. And it's very strong tasting, but wow. That's the kind of oil the people that actually press their own olives get. We need more of that really extra virgin, organic olive oil in our diet. So the bottom line is that there's a lot of benefit in eating olives and having olive oil. And that's a part of the Mediterranean diet. Yet little was previously known about what specific compounds and biochemical interactions in the fruit, and by the way, olives are a fruit, contribute to its medicinal and nutritional benefits. But now we know it can help prevent type 2 diabetes. It helps with weight loss. Yes, it can help the specific biochemical device isolated now is called oleuropein, O-L-E-U-R-O-P-E-I-N, and it helps your body secrete more insulin, a central signaling molecule in the body that controls metabolism. The same compound also detoxifies another signaling molecule called amylin, A-M-Y-L-I-N, that overproduces and forms harmful aggregates in type 2 diabetes. In these two distinct ways, this one chemical in olives or olive oil helps prevent the onset of disease. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Biochemistry. So let's start eating olives in our salads. I like to dice them up and put them into guacamole. In fact, I make my own guacamole. I use wasabi mustard, which is better. It has a little stronger impact. Put in a couple drops of lemon juice, not drops, a teaspoon of lemon juice, some sweet raw onion that you wash under water for about 20 seconds. That gets rid of the volatile oils, but allows all of the sulfur-based nutrients to benefit you, and quercetin. And then I chop up olives and put the olives in, but then I chop up pickles and put the pickle in. Then I fold in the olive oil, a tablespoon, and I blend that. That's how I make my guacamole. Try for yourself. Now from Tokyo Medical University comes a study showing that eating less fat can save your hair. Heart disease, diabetes, and other ailments are extremely common in obese people. However, it's not fully clear how body organs specifically determine what kind of hair loss we have. But you have more hair loss if you're obese. In a recent article published in Nature, the number one science magazine in the world, a group of researchers from Tokyo Medical and Dental University used a mouse model experiments to examine how high-fat diets end up causing hair thinning and loss. And sure enough, fat creates these inflammatory signals, blocking hair follicle regeneration and ultimately resulting in hair thinning and loss of the follicles. So, just lower the fat, especially your saturated fats, which like arachidonic acid from meat, and it can help save your hair. One other thing from the Ecole Polytechnique Institute in Lausanne, Switzerland, pomegranate improves the mitochondrial function and counters age-related disorders. So it's big. By the way, one of the best ways of having pomegranate is put it in a watercress arugula salad. Right? It's delicious that way. With her vibrant scarlet color and sweet but tart flavor, pomegranate has become, I believe for most people who try it, in salad dressings, beverages, desserts, you know, smoothies or salads, a staple. But it's also a superfood. It creates nitric oxide, which means better circulation to your brain, better circulation to your extremities, and to your heart. It helps heal the damage of your heart lining, the epithelium. And anything that improves mitochondria, which is the energy factories, the tiny structures inside the cell that have the all-important task of turning fuel into energy. Over time, however, they can degrade and deteriorate. So when you're young and healthy, your cells are young and healthy. But as you get older, over the age of 40, there's an aging process and you get damaged mitochondria and they break down. And hence you become fatigued. You don't have the muscle strength. And the more mitochondria are malfunctioning, the more they accumulate as debris in the cell, and then they weaken the cell and impair cellular health. So get your mitochondria, because if you don't, that whole process can trigger Parkinson's disease and decrease mobility and cause fragility. And that's why pomegranate comes in, because it has a molecule called urolithin, U-R-O-L-I-T-H-I-N-A. It's produced by the body upon the digestion of two compounds. And these two compounds that exist naturally in pomegranate. So it helps. The pomegranate then helps induce what is called mito, M-I-T-O-phagy, P-H-A-G-Y. And mitophagy prevents the accumulation of dysfunctional mitochondria. It's like a vacuum cleaner cleaning up your cells. So the more pomegranate, the more cleaned up your cells are, the better able they are to function and rejuvenate. This was published in Natural Medicine. I'm looking at the clock. I want to give a lot of time to Chris Hedges. So we're going to take a break. Before I do, I just want to mention two things. As of now, as of yesterday, we have reposted up on GaryandAll.com how to survive COVID. It's about 7.5 hours long. It's got everything that I know that can help you deal with COVID, including protocols, medical protocols from physicians, some of the best in America. Plus, also, there's a whole section what to do if you're in a state like New York or New Jersey, California, and some others that will not allow you your freedom of choice, that will not allow you to be able to go into places and function as if you were not living in an apartheid, vaccine apartheid environment. So, and also the best places to live that will not be adversely affected by extreme weather events. So it's really powerful. Go to GaryandAll.com for that. And also look at the upcoming premiere of Last Call for Tomorrow. Sign up for that. That'll be on the 16th of October, noon. I'm going to show this multi-award-winning film. Plus, I'll be there, and there'll be 2 one-hour discussions with two of the world's greatest environmentalists, including Professor Guy McPherson. So that's that. Also, I'm going to be hiring some people, at least interviewing. Hopefully, I get the right person, a full-time bookkeeper. Great job, good pay, great benefits. And that's one, but you got to have experience, got to know how to use the different, computer systems and do all this. You have to have a background in it. And also a project manager that oversee a lot of the projects, because I'm not in our New York office and I got a lot of things going on. And also, this is for Florida, because I've got my archive all set, thousands and thousands of films, but I don't have anyone. Got the equipment, got the screens, monitors. I need someone to sit there and watch films and then edit upload them by category. And then we're setting up a master file, so the audience from all over the world, free of charge, the public service, can go there and download anything on any topic. If you want the latest on the immune system, you want the latest on cancer, all the people I've filmed over the years, you'll be able to see, take notes. And so it's going to be probably the largest private repository of health information in the world. And it's going to be free, but I need someone to sit there at least for 3 months each day, get paid, free room and board. But that is the next stage. For all of these, if you want to contact, go to prnstudio@gmail.com. prnstudio@gmail.com. We're going to take a break and come back with Chris Hedges. I'm Gary Knoll. Now to our guest to discuss something that is rarely mentioned in the mainstream media, certainly not in any depth, that is mass incarceration and the civil rights issues of our time. Joining us is Chris Hedges. He is one of our nation's most insightful cultural critics, social and political activist, and investigative journalist. He is also a Presbyterian minister and a visiting university lecturer. And for two decades, Chris was a foreign correspondent in war zones and conflicts in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, having reported for the New York Times and other news outlets for over 50 countries. And while at the Times, he received a Pulitzer Prize for reporting on global terrorism. That same year, he received Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights Journalism. Chris has authored many best-selling books. His most recent book will be released shortly, Our Class, Trauma and Transformation in an American Prison, which is a heart-rending account of Chris's 8 years as a humanities teacher in the East New Jersey State Prison in Rahway, and the stories and insights about the internal transformation of his student inmates who had spent years in maximum security prisons for severe crimes, including murder. Chris hosts the weekly TV program On Contact with interviews prominent with dissidents ignored by the media. It airs every Saturday on Russian TV or RTV.com, and his website is chrislhedges.com. Nice to have you with us today, Chris.
Thanks, Gary.
I'd like to begin with a proposition for your comments, and then we'll wind back to your own experiences teaching in the Rahway prison. For many people, and sadly for so many of our elected officials, there is a culture of reified bias and prejudiced beliefs that perpetrators of serious criminal acts such as murder or rape are irredeemable. It is as if these people, largely people of color and other minorities, are mentally defective, and those that support the most inhumane prison conditions would want us to believe this is hardwired and permanent. I contribute a large part of this utterly false belief to the increasingly dominant paradigm in the life sciences, notably neuroscience and the brain sciences, but going back to the father of materialistic behavioralism, John Watson, in 1910. And this dogma states that all mental and emotional activity, as well as consciousness itself, is magically hardwired in the brain. And of course, there is not an iota of confirmatory scientific evidence to prove that. Yes, there are correlations between mental afflictions in the brain, but that does not preclude causation. Following the logic, therefore, they are somewhat less human than those who do not commit crimes. We might trace this back to a great philosopher and many others at the time who deprived all animals, other humans, of possessing a soul. Or going back further, let's say to Aristotle, who denied animals had any moral reason and existed solely for the benefit of humans. I believe this is a belief embedded in our Eurocentric worldview. Therefore, animals can be treated harshly because they don't possess conscious feelings and emotions. And equally, colonial Europeans would apply this same belief to Native Americans and Africans brought over as slaves. Nevertheless, for so many people in our nation's prisons, they are then branded as permanent threats to the illusion of our civilized society, and therefore they must be put away and simply isolated behind walls with armed patrols into facilities you describe as warehouses. So I'd like you to explain to us your thoughts about the deeper underpinnings within our legal and prison systems and our legislators that can enable a nation to treat other humans so inhumanely as if they were simply livestock in a slaughterhouse. Your thoughts, because you have called mass incarceration the civil rights issue of our time. So what is the mindset that has brought us here? And then please provide us with a sense of just how bad it is. The forum is yours.
So I would begin with Emile Durkheim's book on suicide, which was an important book in terms of informing my own reporting in my last book, America the Farewell Tour. And in America the Farewell Tour, I looked at the various pathologies, self-destructive pathologies that plague the United States. The opioid crisis, gambling, the sexual sadism embodied in pornography, the rash of suicides, the rise of hate groups. And Durkheim blames this kind of self-destructive behavior on the rupture of social bonds. All of those bonds that integrate us into a society, give us a sense of dignity, purpose, meaning, and a place, in essence. And I think that we have to begin looking at mass incarceration with the understanding that for people in poor communities, these poor urban centers, what Malcolm X called our internal colonies, the social bonds have been destroyed. The state does not provide the services, whether that's in terms of adequate schools or safety or housing or health. And most importantly, it doesn't provide employment by which people can find a sense of purpose and earn a sustainable income by which they can maintain themselves and their families. All of that is absent. And that causes a disintegration within these communities that then give birth to the self-destructive pathologies. And we are, of course, watching, as you well know, this same kind of desperate nihilistic behavior now infect the white working class. It was, of course, people of color in urban centers who were hit with deindustrialization and austerity first, but this is now rippling through the country. So with the rupturing of those social bonds, you needed to find, or the state needed to find, other forms of effective social control. And that, I think, came in three ways. One, which Joe Biden was instrumental in creating, and that was the militarizing of our police into rogue paramilitary units licensed to use lethal and indiscriminate force, create reigns of terror. I don't use the word terror lightly in these internal colonies. And of course, the huge expansion of mass incarceration. We hold 25% of the world's prison population. We are less than 5% of the world's prison population in horrific conditions. 80,000 people on any one day in this country are held in solitary confinement, which all human rights groups consider a form of torture. And then I would also add evictions. The inability to find stable housing means that families, often single mothers, because the men, of course, have been removed from these communities, can never find stable living conditions, often having to move, you know, once or twice a year, if not more. And this ruptures any sense of community, any ability to build a community structure by which you can confront these forces. So all of this is happening within these internal colonies, and my students were mostly forced into the illegal economy in order to survive. And that illegal economy brings with it a kind of violence, especially if you're selling drugs. So I remember teaching a student, I've taught in several prisons in New Jersey, including the Supermax, the prison in Trenton. And I remember a student saying that there's an entire subset within poor communities that prey on drug dealers because they know that they have drugs and they have money. And he told me, I wouldn't even take my garbage out in front of my house unless I was carrying two weapons because of those who would attack him and take his money and his drugs. And this kind of devolution of society has the kinds of consequences that are again replicated in any society that disintegrates. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia. So it's not a question of culture or race. It's a question of poverty, which is George Bernard Shaw correctly says is the greatest of all crimes. Many of my students were put in prison because of moments when they were in a confrontation that ended with the death of one of the people that they were having an altercation with. So they did commit a homicide, but they're not by nature killers. There are killers in prison, by the way, very small percentage. And most of the rest of the prison steers very clear of them because, of course, that's a mental health issue. I remember once telling my students about being in firefights when I covered the war in El Salvador, and the Salvadoran soldiers didn't want to get killed, so they used to take their M16 and hold it up over their heads and duck behind a trench or a wall and just fire wildly into the underbrush where FMLN rebels were shooting at them. And somebody said, well, that's exactly like a drive-by shooting. I think that is first and foremost important to remember, that these people are not pathologically or psychologically prone towards violence or killing, but they're in an environment where, as Malcolm X said when he was a hustler on the streets of Boston and New York, he didn't have the luxury to be nonviolent, the way Martin Luther King, who grew up in the black bourgeoisie, did. And then also, I think we have to acknowledge that huge numbers, you know, nobody has the figures, but anecdotally, I would say up 20 or 30% of the students that I teach did not commit the crime for which they're charged. But because of corrupt police departments, who will plant evidence or get them to sign false confessions, they are serving life sentences. And usually the students who refuse to plea out have the longest sentences because, as Michelle Alexander points out, the system is not designed to carry out jury trials. 94% of the people in our prison system never had a jury trial. If everyone had their right to a jury trial, the system would collapse. So the tactic is to coerce, and I use that term quite consciously, to coerce people into accepting pleas. And the way you do that is you stack tons of charges against them, which the prosecutors and the police understand are fictitious, but which, if you go to court, you will be charged with. I mean, for instance, kidnapping, now that's a favorite that police love to tack on, or prosecutors love to tack on, whether you did it or not, because that's a 25-year sentence. So you can say, look, you're facing 30 to life, but you can take a plea out for 9 or whatever it is. The students that I teach who have the longest sentences are always the ones who went to trial because they didn't plea out. And they're often the ones who didn't commit the crime because they naively thought because they were innocent, they would be found innocent. And these sentences are horrific. They're unlike sentences we see anywhere else in the industrialized world. So I'll give you one example. I taught a student. He was an orphan. His parents had died. His father had died when he was very young, 2 or 3. His mother died when he was about 12. He was living in an abandoned house in Camden, New Jersey. There was a rape and a killing of a woman, and he was picked up by the police, dragged into the police station. Now, remember, he's 14 years old. He weighs 90 pounds, and they coerce him to sign a confession telling him that if he signs it, he can go home. He gets to court and they read this confession and he's appalled. He said, it's not true. I didn't do it. It doesn't matter. He's convicted as an adult, sent off to prison, and he's not eligible to go before the parole board until he's 70 years old. Now, we did, through a great public attorney, Jennifer Saletti in New Jersey, get him a resentencing hearing under the Supreme Court statutes that you can no longer charge a minor or convict a minor as if they are an adult, and he's out and he's graduated summa cum laude from Rutgers University. And but that's just a one example of many as to how appalling our system is. And then just to close, I would add that under RICO laws, people are picked up for crimes that they had no involvement in, but they were in close proximity to. So, for example, I have one student. He was just turned 18. He was in a car with two older men who were in their 20s, you know, listening to a 50 Cent song on the radio. The two men went in to rob a convenience store. The owner reached for a weapon. They had a weapon. They shot and killed the owner. They run back to the car. Now, he had nothing to do with the robbery. He certainly didn't have any involvement in the killing, but he gets 18 years because he's in the car, in essence. He's out now in Newark and struggling, homeless, because he was went into prison basically as a very young person and has none of the skills or experience by which to cope. And of course, he's been cast into the criminal caste system whereby which he can't get works. He was working at Whole Foods. Then when the background check came in, they immediately fired him, although he was a model employee. And I went to the manager and it makes no difference. He can't get public assistance. He can't get public housing. And so that's the system by which the dispossessed people, what in Marxian terms, the surplus labor, those who have been cast aside by deindustrialization and austerity and neoliberalism, the prison, the police and the prison are those are the forms by which these people are kept in check because the social bonds that once had integrated them into the society are no longer exist. And we can see that as we drive through any major city in America, whether it's Detroit or Cleveland or Camden or Newark or anywhere else, the destruction of industry, the absence of industry and of jobs has essentially cast aside a huge segment of the American population who are treated as if they are human refuse.
Chris, you touch on a very deep psychological truth, one that I often share with participants in my anti-aging retreats, and that is we define our sense of self and an extension self-worth based upon what others think or project upon us. Deep individual introspection is not a characteristic trait of our modern mindset, since we also seek outside of ourselves for self-definition and hedonic and transient happiness and well-being. The average American is utterly, in my personal opinion, clueless about genuine well-being or the eudaimonia. And your work to introduce prisoners to both classical and modern literature, poetry and theater, as a gateway to self-discovery, produced extraordinary transformation, and I'm certain to bring forth their humanness and make them appreciate the empathy that has been within them, whether they've exhibited it in the past or not. So prisoners find themselves in dire situation, which was also the case when they were civilians, and then the system tries to equate these dreadful conditions with who they actually are, as if it were an inherent birthright. So what is our warehouse prison system fundamentally missing? And who runs all this? Who creates the programs and the paradigm that seems to be unable to change itself? What are we ignoring and most denying in our treatment of prisoners?
Well, prisons are just, they're in essence plantations. Under the 13th Amendment, people who are imprisoned are legally allowed to be treated as if they are slaves. And that goes back to the response by the white majority after the Civil War and convict leasing, which was just slavery by another name. People were African Americans in the South who, after slavery, were, of course, landless. They weren't given Although they built the South and built much of the country, railroads and the U.S. Capitol and all sorts of stuff, this is the whole issue of reparations. They were never paid for their labor. And so they were relegated into this system of sharecropping and a kind of permanent underclass. But anyway, they were picked up under convict leasing. And in fact, of course, the mortality rate under convict leasing, where people were charged with fictional crimes, as they are today, vagrancy and this kind of stuff, they could go off and work for 6-7 years on a plantation in the turpentine camps in southern Florida. And the mortality rates were astronomical because now they were treated as slaves, as enslaved people. But the white owners or the white overseers no longer had to buy them, and so their lives were far more expendable. So it's been a long there's a protean nature to white supremacy, and the response after emancipation was to criminalize being black. And that was the response after the 1960s and 70s, when you had the Black Power movement, the uprising in Attica, a massive explosion to criminalize being black, in essence. And so there's a long continuity in American society. These prison systems didn't just arise like Venus on a half shell. They are the natural denouement of white supremacy and institutional racism. So we have roughly 2.3 million of our citizens incarcerated. About 1 million of them work for for-profit corporations. They make, for instance, McDonald's makes its uniforms in the prison. And they are sweatshops. They are American sweatshops. So they're paid 50 cents, 22 cents, whatever it is an hour, maybe at the high end, a dollar an hour. They can't organize. The employers don't have to pay Social Security. If they are unruly or in any ways attempt to challenge the often very poor conditions in their working environment, they can be instantly removed into isolation units. They, of course, can't unionize. And then within prisons themselves, prisons wouldn't function without prison labor, who do all the jobs, all the cooking. I mean, I used to go into the prison in Rahway, and they have a barber shop, and they have prisoners in barber uniforms to cut the guards' hair. I mean, one of the highest paying jobs in Trenton, they call it the boot black N-word, and it's the prisoner who shines the boots of the prison guards. And so internally, prisons are run, they are the modern iteration of plantations. But what we have seen in the last few years is something even more pernicious, and that is for-profit corporations intruding on the prison system to extract profits from the most vulnerable within our society. So the phone service, Global Tellink, is privatized, and of course, mercenary in terms of its charges. The money transfer service, JPay, huge food corporations, RMR, which serves and takes care of the meals in prisons, many of which are unedible and rancid, and there are constant cases of contaminated food and sickness. The commissaries are privatized. The medical service is privatized. So this has become a multi-billion dollar industry. And these lobbyists are in state capitals and in Washington writing the legislation that essentially guarantee high recidivism rates. 76% of those released within 5 years are back inside prison within that 5-year span. And that, of course, is exactly what these corporations want. They want these cages to be kept full because in corporate America, the bodies of poor people of color on the streets of Newark or Camden or Detroit are worth nothing in the eyes of corporations, but they can generate $50,000-$60,000 a year if they're locked in a cage to these prison contractors and the guards and all the companies that make the restraint hoods and the restraint belts and the boss chair, which x-rays your cavities. And then, of course, all the private corporations that function parasitically to make profits off of these people and their families. And so there is a very demented, twisted logic to the massive prison population we have in this country. It functions, of course, as I mentioned earlier, as a form of social control, but it also functions to increase the profits of these corporations, which are highly, highly profitable and are billion-dollar industries.
Now your class is in prison, and I imagine we should remark this is, and it was an extension of Rutgers University. These classes introduce them to literature and philosophy. I'm curious about some of the specific texts that you had them read and why you decided on these books. And what was it about these readings, especially about the role of inspiration in all of our lives, that you feel contributed to their transformation? And when you started this work, did you have any idea that the results would be as transformative as it was?
I didn't. And this was a class that I taught. The book it revolves around the writing of a play. And so I taught a class, it was 2013, and I had them read works of drama that August Wilson and James Baldwin, Miguel Pinero, Amiri Baraka, and others. And when I began the class, it was clear that they had very little exposure to drama, to dramatic work. Not surprisingly, there aren't theaters in their communities. They don't have $150 to go see August Wilson on Broadway, unfortunately. I think August Wilson is one of our greatest playwrights. And so I said, well, why don't you write scenes from your life? In dramatic form, whether it's inside or outside prison. And what I didn't know is that one of my students, who was, by the way, a devoted listener of Gary Null, Robert Luma or Kabir, a wonderful guy, had heard me on WBAI, and he had recruited the best writers in the prison. I mean, really talented writers. So when I got home and I started reading, I had 28 students, I started reading through these scenes. I was hitting 3, 4, 5. I mean, they were just really powerful and incredibly well written. And after a couple weeks of this, my wife is an actor, and I showed her some of this, and I said, you know, I think I'll take it and help them write a play. I was supposed to be writing a book, which I had to drop. I added another class. Each week, I can add a class if students need remedial help. So I just signed the whole class up for remedial help. And there was a little grumbling, but they all went. And we set out to write this play called Cage about their lives inside and outside prison. And this was all accidental. It wasn't planned. But in prison, people, you don't even often tell people your legal name. You keep your emotions, your history to yourself. Showing any kind of weakness, vulnerability, including grief, or in a predatory environment like that can be dangerous, really. And so suddenly in this classroom, people are writing about these incredibly traumatic and personal events in their lives. Guys in the classroom, you know, and they're huge. They call it the 400 Club, which means they all bench over 400 pounds. you know, sitting up there covered with prison tattoos. Their hands are shaking. Tears sometimes are running down their face, or they can't even read it at all. And all of it just poured out. And that was the power of the play. It was interesting. I said, well, we'll write a play, and how many people want parts? And then the first couple of weeks, seven people said, we want parts. By, you know, 4, 5, 6 weeks into it, everybody in the play wanted a part. I had to write 28. We had to write 28 parts. And and that's my book. That process of writing a play is the vehicle by which I expose what happened to my students and the nature of the prison system itself. So everything in that play happened to someone in the classroom, including just these incredible stories. One where a student is incarcerated at the prison in Trenton, and on his first night, the guard comes and tells him that that's the cell his father used to be in. I had a student who I said, well, I worked as kind of the editor of it, you know, putting the pieces together, and the play was eventually performed at the theater in Trenton, New Jersey, the Passage Theater, sold out every night. We had a night for the families of the playwrights, which was very moving. A few minutes into it, people started sobbing and sobbed through the entire play, and then it was eventually published by Haymarket. But I had a student, I said, well, write a scene with your mother. And he came up to me after the class and he said, well, what if we're a product of rape? And I said, well, Timmy, that's what you have to write. So he writes a scene, which is autobiographical. He's in the county jail. He'd been in a car with his half brother. There was a weapon in the car. They were picked up. And if nobody will admit to possession of the weapon, they're all charged. They all get a weapons charge. And even though it wasn't his weapon, he tells the police, it's mine. And the phone call from the county jail to his mother is, it doesn't matter, Ma, I was never supposed to be here anyway, but you have the son you love. And that's why he's in prison. And he crumpled when we had the final reading. Cornel West and the great theologian James Cone came in as our audience, and he had never spoken about this publicly. And after the reading, I said, where's Timmy? And they said, I think he's in the bathroom. I found him huddled in the corner, shaking and sobbing. So the play opened up the pain and the suffering and the indignities and the yearnings and the struggle for integrity and meaning, all of these things that lie buried within the prison. And I don't think that's, now it's 8 years later, increasingly my students are getting out. I was just down in Camden with one of my students the other day. It created a bond between myself and those within that classroom runs very, very deep. And I think changed all of our lives.
Could you give us a few examples of the prisoners' personal transformations that you witness? And then what should this tell us about the power of literature, art, and theater?
Well, I think the transformations that I saw is that for the first time in many cases, these people were confronting the traumatic psychological scars that they bore. But what was important is, as one of my great students, a very fine writer in his own right, Horace Franklin, said, that it became clear that in essence, it was all one story with variations. We all had the same story in one way or another. And that created a kind of solidarity. There is a tendency, even in a prison, for people to blame themselves. And I think there became an understanding this wasn't what these people endured wasn't unique to them, but had been endured by people that they may have been in on the tier with or in a cell with. But because they didn't have that moment where it was explored and expressed, they never knew. So it broke down those walls, emotional walls. And that is the power of great art. That's why art exists. Great literature, great poetry, great music. It's about all getting us in touch with those vital elements of human existence, which are not irrational, but they're non-rational. Or those forces that make up a complete life that can't be measured: grief, beauty, love, the struggle for a life of meaning, the coping with our own mortality, all of these things. I mean, the Buddhists say you can memorize as many sutras as you want. It will never make you wise. And that's what art does. It makes us complete human beings. And I think that's what I saw in that classroom.
On a final note, we now live in a society that is at war with itself, and it is escalating. Instead of we seeing the sentientness of all beings, irrespective of their culture, their ethnicities, their age, their political beliefs, we are separating people. Can you please address this topic, especially the cancel culture and the new liberal reverse racism that is permeating the media?
Well, the problem is that you're talking about the woke culture. I mean, they're not confronting the real centers of power. They're kind of turning on themselves because these monolithic corporate forces, this corporate coup d'etat that has taken place, the rise of the American oligarchy as embodied by the Democratic Party or the traditional wing of the Republican Party, the Jeb and George Bushes and Mitt Romneys, et cetera. Of course, now they've all made common cause because what they fought over in the past was what Freud called the narcissism of minor differences. And as with many decayed democracies or decayed societies, we have seen the rise of an autocracy, most recently around a figure like Donald Trump. But I tie this rise of autocracy back to the Christian right. Trump tapped into this zeitgeist. He didn't create it. Yes, the media has responded, the mass media has responded by essentially catering to a particular demographic. It's what Matt Taibbi correctly in his book called Hate Versus Hate. And on one side of the book, he has Rachel Maddow, and the other side of the book, he has Sean Hannity. So you cater to that demographic, tell that demographic what it wants to hear, and at the same time demonize the other demographic, which widens the kinds of divides. You never speak in the language of class, which is, of course, fundamental. As Fred Hampton, the great Black Panther organizer in Chicago, was assassinated by the Chicago police and the FBI, understood. Yes, they're all of the forces politically, in terms of mass media, are widening these divisions, which are very dangerous, as I saw in Yugoslavia, because it promotes a kind of demonization and dehumanization of the other on both sides. Hillary Clinton talking about deplorables, for instance. And then what you have is the rise of this moral purity in place of politics. It's really anti-politics. So you begin to go after each other. You know, it's kind of like these Maoist encounter groups or something. But it's politically irrelevant. It is about the self-adulation of the moral arbiters who carry it out. And it really plays into corporate power because they're quite happy to at least adopt the veneer of being politically correct and identity politics, although, of course, they pervert it. I mean, if you go back to the second wave feminists, the great writers like Andrea Dworkin, she understood that feminism was about empowering oppressed women. It wasn't about having a woman CEO or a woman, national security advisor or a woman president. Even that in and of itself has been perverted and twisted.
Okay. Chris, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. I want to thank you very much. Chris Hedges, my guest. I'm Gary Null. We're going to say goodbye because our sister station WBI has cut away for news. But call in now at 888-874-4888 because we'll go to the top of the hour with your feedback. 888-874-4888 on any of the topics. And just a few things while you're calling in. Again, I want to mention that the How to Survive COVID, the most comprehensive webinar I've ever done, it was packed. Thousands of people couldn't get on, unfortunately. So now it's your time and your opportunity to go to GaryNall.com, and there it is, and you can see it for yourself. Also, the film, you can sign up, and that will also be packed. And it's not just the film, the most award-winning documentary in world history, but it has been called by different film festivals. We have all their letters, by the way, and I don't know these people. You don't know who the judges are. They're always kept secret. But these are some of the most critical film festivals in the world saying this is the best documentary on the environment ever done. So it's time that we become aware. What are the real problems? Who's behind them? And why is it that no matter who's in power, nothing ever changes? Because all people in power are controlled by the power elite, the corporatization of all governmental agencies, the full capture of the media, and the supplicants that they are, so we the people never see the other side of the story. And there's always another side of the story. So I'd like to see what your thoughts are. Anyhow, the film, go to GaryNall.com. You'll see how you can sign up for the film, and also you can sign up for the webinar, which is there now. Also, just a quick reminder to the people in this audience, I am now in the process of eliminating some of the inventory, 5 or 6 items. I have over 50, but these are items that were made by one manufacturer who, because of COVID, and they may be completely honest about this, they increased the amount I can order by a huge margin beyond my financial means. I'd have to order $250,000 per order. I don't have that kind of money. I'm just a little tiny company. But I make what many consider the finest quality, highest integrity products there are, and most unique. So that includes we're eliminating and selling out of the aloe vera shampoo, the aloe vera conditioner, the aloe vera skin cleanser, the one of the best products of all. If we're not already out of it, we're down to like 10 or 15 left. I used to call it the anti-aging elixir, a moisturizing cream. Now we just call it the full body moisturizer, and a new product. But again, couldn't get it back in inventory, and that is our vegetable broth. So those are being eliminated completely until I can find another manufacturer willing to maintain the same standards and quality of ingredients and manufactured in a number I can actually purchase, you know, like 1,000 bottles instead of 25,000 bottles. So COVID has really devastated the product market out there. In fact, I just reordered one of my products, and I just got the shipment in, the past shipment, because it might take 6 months to get all the ingredients, where it used to take 6 weeks. That's what's going on. And I don't lower the quality of my ingredients. I say, no, you keep it till you get it. So if you want to get any of these products, you can get them now while they're still in inventory. And just call our number. And I'm going to ask Jesse to give me the number. I'll give it to you because I don't have it in front of me. And you can call that and speak. You can call Neil in the vitamin department. And Neil's number is 646-926-5430. 646-926-5430. He's there Monday. No, he's there, yeah, Monday to Saturday, noon to 8 o'clock at night. Or you can call Sandy or Diane at 877-627-5065, and they'll go over any of these products. Again, understand I'm running out of inventory, so when they're gone, because I can't replace, I can't do a new order because of the huge number I would have to order. I don't see any calls up. right this second. Do we have? Now, stay tuned for one of those popular programs on the Progressive Radio Network and one of the most insightful that you can call in and share your thoughts with Utrecht Lead right now.